A wrap of the Afghanistan Island Tour, rain in PNG, the USA in the UAE, and a Sandeep PSL wrap. All that and more coming up in the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast, where we dissect the news and events from cricket's new world. Episode 4 today in Hong Kong. Tim Cutler. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm counting down the days till I make the move back to Australia, but otherwise I'm good, Bez.
Ah, good to hear another valued member of the country back on their own shores. And just up the road from me, we have Nick Skinner, known by many as Copernicus Cricket. Nick, how are you?
Oh, not too bad. Struggling with my cricket bat, which I made the rookie mistake of oiling before I'm sanding it, so...
That's disgusting.
Why are you sanding after...
Yeah, let's not get into that.
Oh, there's just so much to unpack there. This isn't what we're going on about for this podcast, but everything's changed. What's going on?
Indecision, mate, indecision. I started off oiling it and then I was like, oh, nah, got to sand it down because it's just a mess. Then obviously because I've oiled it first, now it's just more of a mess. So that's some.
Mate, were you raised in a barn?
That's why you don't oil it first, kids.
And now you've got lovely oily sandpaper to go with everything else.
Exactly.
I'm gonna sweep that one under the carpet because we've got a lot to get through tonight, boys. We're gonna jump straight in. Ireland and Afghanistan in India, their tour has wrapped up. We did discuss the T20 series in the last podcast, so if you're looking for a dissection of that, feel free to go to episode 3. But tonight we're going to discuss the ODI series and the test match. Just running through the 5 one-day internationals that they did play. There were only 4 completed. One was washed out. In the first one-day, Afghanistan won the first one-day by 5 wickets, chasing down 162. The second ODI was washed out. The third ODI, Ireland chased down a total of 257, 6 down. Fourth one-day international, Afghanistan won by 109 runs. And in the fifth one-day international, Ireland leveled the series at 2-2, chasing down 217. They did that by 5 wickets. Boys, there were, I guess, while we have discussed these two teams quite a lot over the past couple of weeks, there has been some rather telling things coming out of the one-day internationals. Looking at someone like William Porterfield, who has struggled with his footwork at times. Tim, where do you kind of sit William Porterfield now? He's not getting any younger and still opening the batting for Ireland and captaining the team. How do you assess his sort of current performance?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think when the skipper is struggling for runs, especially knowing how key he's been to getting Ireland to where they are and putting plans in to grow as a full member side now, it's a tough one. And there's always so much pressure there to lead the side, and you know, one of the reasons why we don't see a lot of fast bowlers captains are them being able to concentrate and lead on the field. So look, I hope if there is a deficiency there that he can get through that, because he's been such a big part of Ireland's emergence and is such a great advocate for the growth of the game. So I hope that comes through, and hopefully he doesn't sort of go the way of Peter Byron and sort of making a call to bow out. So yeah, I hope they've got some players behind him. Now, I didn't see anyone else sort of seeing the world alight and the Wolves tour that might be coming through, and hopefully with Balburnie and whatnot starting to turn potential into performances, hopefully that they can shore up that top order, because it has looked shaky throughout this entire series, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think if we're looking for succession planning, it seems like Sterling or Wilson are probably next in line to take the mantle. But yeah, as Porterfield's just been such a charismatic figure in Ireland's rise. You know, he was there as a junior member of the side when they beat Pakistan all those years ago, and he's been a a rock ever since, really, at the top of the order. So yeah, it's tough when someone so talismanic to the side is starting to potentially lose a bit of form. But I guess he's hoping he can do a bit of a Mark Taylor and turn his form around.
Yeah, well, just to quickly wrap up the Porterfield discussion, he's turning 35 this year. And as you said, Nick, it does look like they're trying to blood Sterling into the captaincy role, and he seems to be picking it up well when he's needed. We'll go to someone showing a lot of promise with the bat for Ireland, and that's Andy Balburnie. It seems at the moment that if Balburnie doesn't make runs for Ireland, they seem to get themselves in a little bit of trouble. But he did make an unbeaten 100. I think it was 145 not out in their successful chase of 257. He also backed it up with a score in the second innings of the Test match. Just how vital is Andy Balburnie to this Irish team at the moment?
Oh, he's definitely their, I guess, linchpin for the batting, really. He's looked really good in this series, actually. A bit sort of boom or bust, though. You know, like he scored that century and then sort of not a lot. And then so I think he really needs to work on his consistency. But that was some innings, wasn't it? Absolutely smoked them around the field and just looked fantastic. And he's always been, you know, really talented going back to when he, you know, first broke onto the scene. But he had quite a few injuries, a couple of years ago, and he's been patchy since. But yeah, hopefully he's starting to turn it around and, really repaying the faith they've shown him. Because when he gets going, he's absolutely fantastic to watch.
Yeah, watching that 145 not out, I seem to have missed all of his run getting innings. So it was, as you said, amazing to watch. They're hitting sixes in parts of the field that just made it look so simple. So for Ireland's sake, and as you said, when he does well, when he does poorly, they don't do well. So for their sake, hopefully he can get that consistency up. His second top run scorer in both the ODIs and the one-off test. So just as how important he is.
Yeah, he. You mentioned that thing about the you've missed a lot of his innings. That's how I felt about Callum McLeod until I watched that England ODI. Actually, I hadn't actually seen him go off, and was sort of, what's all this fuss about? But yeah, watching Balburnie, I saw him make the double 100 against the Netherlands, and he just pure class. So it's good that he's coming good at the top level, really.
Something that popped out to me that I don't think got talked about a lot was Ashgar Afghan scoring 226 across the five ODIs, playing a very MS Dhoni-like role there in coming in mid-order and just being able to control the game really well, even after a couple of mini collapses. So that was really impressive. And, I think Afghanistan's chances at the World Cup, whilst they've got some explosive players around him, I think they'll really need a sheet anchor role there. And I'm excited to see how he takes on that responsibility as well as the captaincy as well. So, if we thought a few of these guys might have been getting a bit older, it was really good to see him perform.
Yeah, that sort of middle order stabilizing role is one he's performed for them in the past, actually. He scored a crucial, I think it was 70-odd, with a hamstring injury against Ireland in the Cricket World Cup qualifiers when they were wobbling a bit on the chase of a middling kind of total, and he just, really guided them home. And so his cool head is something that's going to be really important coming up against the strong level of bowling at the World Cup. And interested to see how the artist formerly known as Ashgar Stanikzai performs.
Yeah, well, the Ashgar Stanikzai transformation into Ashgar Afghan is quite a fascinating story in itself. Many would remember him as Ashgar Stanikzai. He changed his name and, quote, in honour of protecting the national identity of Afghan citizens, end of quote, which I found quite patriotic. Afghanistan were quite good. One thing that I've noticed between these two sides with the bat, especially in the limited overs format, is that if teams tend to lose early wickets or they collapse early, Afghanistan have been able to kind of save themselves from complete and utter collapse, whereas Ireland at times have just kind of fallen over. A good example of that was the fourth one-day international, actually. Afghanistan was 6 for 81, ended up making 223 thanks to Ashgar, Muhammad Nabi, and I think Rashid Khan. And then Ireland, in comparison, were actually 6 for 90 themselves, but they fell to 114 all out. One of the members of that lower order is Najibullah Zadran, and for me, he just flies under the radar a little bit. Every time we seem to watch or look at Afghanistan's scorecards, he always seems to make runs. And I had a look at his numbers a little earlier. His strike rate's phenomenal, and his average in both the limited overs formats is actually quite good. So I don't know, maybe at the World Cup, he might be a smoky for being a guy, I guess, an unsung hero for Afghanistan. Boys, I'll jump straight into the Test match as well, because I do know that we've got a lot to get through tonight. They were playing for, well, we dubbed it the Leaning Tower of Pisa trophy. It was actually a trophy that symbolised the Minaret of Jam, which is actually a leaning minaret in Afghanistan, I believe, which I found quite interesting reading pre the test match.
Yeah, I reckon we should have more trophies modelled on historical monuments.
Yeah, I'll get on board with that as well.
Well, I've got to be better than Big Biscuit, surely.
Yeah.
I like the biscuit.
The Brighto paints, what was it? Whatever the name of that Pakistan trophy was, that was diabolical.
I think it was a Brighto paints powered by biscuits, insured by Johnny Come Lately insurance brokers. Look, don't be wrong, commercial income is important, but to be able to honour monuments and things of national importance perhaps might be the way to go. But yeah, no, I liked it too. I looked at it, I said, I hope this is deliberate because it is definitely leaning. So
it was a big angle.
I was happy to learn that.
Cricket does have a bit of a reputation for some interesting trophies. That Warne Muralitharan trophy is interesting too, with the bowling grips of the two best spinners in Test history.
Does any other sport have as many trophies as cricket, though? Well, maybe there's a podcast in itself there, and maybe a section of the new website when we launch it very shortly could just be, you know, looking back at certainly a cricket brand and shirts, but all the trophies that have been, I can't think of any other sport that would come close.
Well, that's a consequence of how, I guess, international cricket sort of evolved to be the predominant form, and, you know, bilateral touring is still the model. But that's a...
Yes, that word, bilateral.
Mm. That's an issue in itself that we can leave for another time, I think.
Yes.
Well, if we just had picked the kit, maybe we could have picked the trophy.
Oh, yeah. I'd get on board with that.
Well, I'm sure. Well, again, when that website comes up, that's something we can look at. But no, it was good. It was nice to see something with a bit of significance, especially between these two sides.
Yeah, well, it was Afghanistan that did win that trophy. You've got to say, quite convincingly, I don't think they ever really looked in too much danger across this test match. Ireland did, I guess, pull it back on several occasions during the match, but to be quite honest, it did look like Afghanistan were in complete control. Just running through the scorecard, Ireland were bowled out for 172 in the first innings. George Dockrell made 39 and was joined by number 11, Tim Murtagh, who made an unbeaten 54 from 75 balls at number 11 in one of the more remarkable test innings that I've seen in recent memory. And then Afghanistan came out and took a pretty sizable first innings lead. They were bowled out for 314. Rahmat Shah fell agonisingly short of Afghanistan's first test century, being bowled actually by that man, Tim Murtagh, for 98. Shahidi and Asghar Afghan, again, were both in the runs. They both made totals in the 60s. And then Ireland, I guess, trying to fight back. They were looking okay at one point. Andy Balbirnie and Kevin O'Brien in particular look quite comfortable. They both made 50s. Balbirnie made 82, and they were bowled out eventually for 288. Rashid Khan took 5 for 82, his first 5 for in Test cricket, and then chasing a total of 147. They did win by only 7 wickets. It looked like they were going to win by 9 wickets at one point. Insanula finishing off the job with Shahidi as they won by 7 wickets.
Yeah, nice comedy run out there from Muhammad Nabi too.
Yeah. I wasn't gonna bring that one up, to be honest. But yes, you are right. Anyone can go on YouTube and have a look at that. It's up there.
I love a good comedy run out, mate.
But we've got to say, boys, it took Afghanistan just 2 test matches to get their first test win. Admittedly, it was against another newcomer in test cricket to Ireland, but they did join England and Pakistan, I believe, as the only test nations to win their but maiden test match in just 2 matches. Australia did it in their first. Boys, I know we're sounding a bit like a broken record here, but Afghanistan again showing their explosive growth in the last sort of 10 years coming to fruition once again and setting themselves another nice little record in winning their first ever test match.
Yeah, I think this the test match sort of in a way sort of neatly symbolizes the perhaps diverging paths of the two teams here. You know, Afghanistan were sort of second behind Ireland for quite a few years there in the associate world, but over the last little while they've really overtaken them and started making some big strides into the, I guess, the top leagues, whereas Ireland are starting to struggle as some of their some of their golden generation are retiring and they're having a bit of trouble with the rebuilding. So I think in a lot of ways it's not very surprising. Last time Ireland came and played a first class game against Afghanistan in India was during the Intercontinental Cup and that was a couple of years ago, and Afghanistan absolutely thrashed them. So they've probably performed a bit better in this game, but same sort of usual suspects, you know, Rashid bundled them out, Ashgar was in the runs. That I just think Afghanistan are a much better team at the moment, and they're going to keep being a much better team unless Ireland managed to unearth some good replacements for the guys that have retired.
Yeah, I can't add too much more to that, really, from an on-field point of view. You've got a battle of two new sides, Ireland battling to get the game to be mainstream with a great administration, and then you've got Afghanistan, which is basically now the national sport, but with an administration that's going through its own challenges, having recently lost its CEO. The amount of talent coming through the Afghanistan ranks, I think you're right, they're just going to keep getting better and better. And see the names that are coming through now that were only really shown to the world in the Afghanistan Premier League, and seeing what's coming. I guess we hope we see the same thing in the Euro T20 to unearth some new talent for Ireland. But yes, I think it's a sort of very similar music coming from the record player, watching these two teams up against each other.
Yeah, and I think, like we were talking just before the show about the under-19 World Cups, and you can kind of see the upwards trajectory of Afghanistan and the downwards trajectory perhaps of Ireland, in that, you know, last time, I think it was 2018, Afghanistan finished fourth and Ireland finished 13th, finishing behind Canada. So the ranks are a bit thin in terms of the replenishment of the talent, which is a bit of a concern, because as you say, the administration's been fantastic. You know, Warren Jutram's done an amazing job over the last decade, dragging the game from a, you know, tiny niche sport into the rarefied air of full member cricket.
Yeah, well, it's going to be tricky for Ireland, given that they're, I guess, going to be compared to Afghanistan in that they're kind of moving into full membership at the same time. It's a little bit unfair because, I mean, we've seen how ridiculous the growth has been in Afghan cricket, and I don't think any country would come close to emulating that, even, you know, with all the resources possible. One, I guess we have discussed Andy Balburnie already, but I really did enjoy his innings and being in the runs in Test cricket, purely because the first Test for Ireland sort of ended in horror for him. He was given out LBW to Mohammad Abbas twice. For a pair, and there is no shame getting out to Mohammad Abbas. He's a quality bowler, but it was good to see Balburnie get another crack at Test cricket, and he did a magnificent job. But just discussing these LBWs, I've got to say some of the umpiring for the whole tour has left a lot to be desired. Particularly S. Ravi, I felt that his performances over the course of the series have been a little bit questionable. And I don't like being that guy that will sit there and criticize officiating, because I think cricket umpiring is probably the toughest job, or one of the toughest jobs in world sport. And we also didn't have DRS. But I have to say, there were, even in the one-day series, I think Ireland lost 6 LBW decisions in one innings. And I remember 2 or 3 of them not being out. Tim, is this a concern, given that, okay, it is a test match and two test playing teams playing in a tour, but we saw some rather under par officiating? Does it kind of show, or perhaps expose, that the officiating, even at the top level, might not be as in-depth as we would like it to be?
I think a couple of parts to that answer. I think what we saw here was the difference between non-DRS and DRS cricket now, and the difference that it actually makes. I think we're just so used to it now, and the majority of the cricket that most of the world watches, obviously not for us because we watch a lot of our stuff from one camera on YouTube in the Associate Cricket Worlds. But
if we get to watch it at all.
Yeah, if we get to watch it at all. But listening to the Gorilla Cricket guys, friends of the podcast, commentating, they were aghast at why there wasn't DRS. And I think, you know, we've got to remember that the DRS is not the ICC's responsibility at present. Whilst they supply umpires and umpiring and overlook the laws with the MCC, you know, it's actually down to the host broadcaster, and by extension the broadcaster, I should say, to get that. And remembering that Afghanistan and Ireland have a lot smaller commercial income from some of the larger nations, there isn't as much money in these broadcasts for the media companies, so they can't necessarily afford to tack on DRS, which I've heard different numbers. Someone said to about £20,000 a day was what Sky Sports were having to to pay. But what I didn't like was just the lack of consistency in the decision making. It wasn't like, okay, well, I'm going to keep giving these ones out that are similar, that especially as you said, S. Ravi, some of those decisions seem to be flip-flopping either way. And I think Sterlo's off the back foot that was turning the team outside the line that was turning past the stumps was, again, a shocker. And this is why DRS was introduced. But as we saw recently with DRS, where the ball clearly didn't pitch where DRS thought it was, it's also down to the quality of the equipment that you're using. So yeah, I was a little bit disappointed, but I think it just brings us up to speed as to how far we've come with cricket technology.
Yeah, that's a pretty comprehensive answer there from Tim. I almost liked it, really. It's a bit of a nostalgia trip. The idea of, you know, back in the day, you'd tour a country and you had to play the 11 on the field plus the home umpire. So it was a bit of a return to those kinds of scenarios. But I've done a bit of umpiring at, you know, grade level, so I'm not claiming to be particularly good at it, but I can definitely sympathize. You know, it's a tough job, and a lot of the time, you know, once you make a mistake, you sort of get worried about it, and then you start making more mistakes, and, you know, so I can sympathize with Ravi there, the Indian umpire. And just on that, I did see actually that Simon Towfel he's actually working with India at the moment to help train up, I guess, the next generation of umpires. So that's promising signs that they are, you know, trying to address the situation with umpires, and getting in Simon Towfel is a good step, because he's pretty much, you know, the best in the business. But yeah, as you say, Tim, it's some stark reminder of you know, life before DRS, really.
So is that nostalgia that you were missing before DRS, is that the same nostalgia when you oil your bat first and then sand it? Was that a different time?
Yeah, just the nostalgia for making things unnecessarily difficult for yourself.
Oh, dear. Yeah, well, hopefully, boys, in terms of the DRS and the umpiring, we can find, I guess, a consistent ruling across the board for Test cricket and for, I guess, One Day International and T20 cricket, if we cross that bridge. Let's move on, boys, because we've got the East Asia Pacific T20 World Cup qualifiers coming up in Papua New Guinea. It's a tri-nations tournament between the Philippines, Vanuatu, and the host, Papua New Guinea. Nick, I know that you've been looking at the weather forecast with great interest, because it is supposed to rain for most of that tournament. It could potentially cause quite a bit of havoc, as we might not have enough results to, I guess, generate a winner out of the three. What are we going to do if it happens to rain for the entirety of the tournament?
That's a very good question, Bez. No one really seems to know. And I think even Tim's sources within the ICC haven't really confirmed anything either way about what might happen. The I guess predominant theory is that it'll be a sort of count back to the sub-regional qualifier where PNG sailed through undefeated, whereas Vanuatu only just scraped in on net run rate, and the Philippines also had a bit of trouble qualifying. So yeah, realistically, PNG are probably the best team there. So you'd think they would go through, but yeah, the ICC sort of has a history of some strange decisions in these sorts of situations. So I guess really that's what happens when you schedule a 4-day tournament in the middle of the PNG wet season. You're always going to be at risk of this sort of thing. It's apparently not going to be raining the whole time every day, so potentially they can sneak in enough overs to get a game each, and then you'd get some kind of qualification. But yeah, it's definitely less than ideal.
Yeah, I think that's pretty wrapped up there, whether they're going to go by seedings, rankings, or even wrap it into another qualifier. Obviously, we've got a big Asian one coming up as well in Malaysia soon, but we'll see. But yeah, look, I'm really wanting to get a chance to see more of Vanuatu play. So look, I'm hoping to see more of that, whether it's in Port Moresby or in Kuala Lumpur.
Yeah, it definitely would be good to be able to see how these guys match up, and especially, I guess, because I was at the sub-regional B in the Philippines, and just seeing the passion that these guys have, and they, you know, absolutely love playing for the Philippines, and so it'd be very disappointing for them if they don't get a chance to, yeah, to represent their country and to try and compete with the powerhouses of the region, PNG and Vanuatu.
Yeah, well, let's hope we do get some play in Port Moresby over this coming week. I did read somewhere on, it might have been on Twitter from one of our various sources, that there was rumours sort of going around that the ICC could actually nominate who went through, but I don't know how true those speculative comments are. I guess if we do have the unfortunate circumstances of rain impacting the whole tournament. I guess we might find out. Another tour that has been hampered by a little bit of rain is the United States of America's tour of the United Arab Emirates, the USA in the UAE, as I put it in the intro. The first game of that tour was a T20 International that was washed out, no result. And in the second T20 International, UAE won by 24 runs. The telling result for me, I guess, with World Cricket League 2 coming up is the United States defeating the UAE 11. It wasn't their first 11 per se. They won that match by 5 wickets. So they did play a lot of their best players, the United Arab Emirates. But Nick, it does look like that USA could well be the team to beat in a month's time.
As a Canadian, this pains me to say it, but they are looking like a very good team. And I think, yeah, they're going to be very tough to beat with some of the guys they've got coming in. You know, looking, and even someone like Stephen Taylor, who's been in the team for years, and he's just chipped in with a 72 in the first T20, which, you know, the UAE were in a lot of trouble before the rain came. Taylor's been looking in good form. Their passport guys in, you know, Aaron Jones and Hayden Walsh Jr. are both solid players who contributed heavily back in Division 3 last year, and now they've got Xavier Marshall coming into the team from a few years in US club cricket after he was not very good for the West Indies a few years back. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, they're definitely a good team, but I'm not very happy with the way they've gone about it. But I mean, I guess as a Canadian, I can't really talk with you know, Davey Jacobs being parachuted in as captain. So this is just how it goes at this level.
I think you might have actually said we'll be talking about both these teams, but we'll only be talking about one of these because don't forget the UAE beat the Netherlands, beat PNG in the World Cup qualifier rounds, and then, of course, beat Zimbabwe famously or infamously to keep Zimbabwe out of the World Cup. So we're not talking about a side here that that has struggled of late. You know, the UAE have been in really good form. So for the USA to beat them like they did in the 50-over game, I think is shows big signs. I think we'll talk about other sides and their lead up, of course, you know, Canada being in Sri Lanka and Namibia's team being announced recently, but you know, to looking at the sides and how they are prepping for World Cricket League 2, I think USA, as you say, are I wouldn't say a dark horse because they've always been spoken about as having huge potential, but the time they're spending together and starting to gel with those new players is, Nick has mentioned, one way or another. Yeah, I think they're going to be one to watch, definitely.
I just wanted to look at Xavier Marshall. I was just sort of looking at his profile today. He's only 32. I actually thought he was a little bit older than that, given that he played for the West Indies 10 years ago now. 7 test matches, 24 one-day internationals. He didn't exactly set the world alight then. And to be honest, I'm just interested what Xavier Marshall's been doing for the last 10 years because I've barely heard of him since.
Well, he kept playing domestically in the Caribbean for a few years with Jamaica before he sort of dropped off the cricketing radar a bit and floated around the numerous sort of amateur and semi-pro leagues in America and followed the time-honoured career pathway for washed-up fringe players from the West Indies by pulling on a USA jersey.
Just go for it.
I guess I'm probably being a bit unfair, really, because, you know, you can't blame the US for trying to pick their best side possible and, you know, you certainly can't blame Xavier Marshall for wanting to play international cricket. I know that was certainly a dream for all of us growing up. So, you know, more power to him for pursuing that dream. I guess it's more of a structural question with the game over there, which is probably something we should leave for another time. But, yeah, getting back to the on-field performances, as we go to air, the Americans, and let's remember, they are American and, you know, they are very proud of representing America, and America is a proudly multicultural society. And yeah, they're once again showing that they're hitting some good form with a 6-wicket victory in another practice match against Lancashire this time, who are also in the UAE preparing for the upcoming county season. Lancashire were restricted to 221 with Alabama-born left-arm orthodox bowler Nothtush Kenjige claiming a career-best 5-for-27 as he ripped through the top order. And then our friend Xavier Marshall decided to show me up by leading a comfortable chase with 75. So yeah, very very good signs for the US, as you were saying. You know, the playing group looking like they're gelling. And, yeah, it was a decent strength Lancashire County lineup, actually. You know, it's not the academy side. It's a couple of England test players in there. So,
Yeah, as you were saying, they're a very good chance to win both promotion and potentially even the whole tournament over at World Cricket League Division 2 next month.
You happy to move on there, Tim?
Yeah, I think Nick made his feelings clear here and I'm fine. I said my piece.
Yeah, well, plenty to look forward to from that USA and UAE sides for, I guess, World Cricket League 2 coming up next month, which is a month tomorrow. We are recording this on the eve. It will be a month until we're there, boys. Looking forward to that immensely. But an event that is going on right now in Namibia is the Under-19 Cricket World Cup African qualifiers. And some interesting results coming out of that so far. Nigeria, for me, I guess a rising force in associate cricket. They thumped the host Namibia in the first game. Uganda and Sierra Leone actually recorded big victories against Kenya and Tanzania, respectively. And then Nigeria came out and spanked Kenya in the second game. And Uganda and Nigeria, I guess, have been the two leading sides in all of this so far. Huge population in Nigeria, and they have got, English roots. The main language is English. So I'm assuming that I guess, cricket is in the Nigerian discourse. But, boys, they could well be a sleeping giant come a decade or two down the track. It looks like they're performing well at youth level, and hopefully that can translate into senior cricket.
Absolutely. I think we've seen recently with them trying to complete the new cricket ground or grounds near the National Stadium in Abuja. I think that was a butt of a few jokes over the last few years about it actually being finished. I think it's been under construction for 5 years or so. But they've also just recently completed the ICC's commercial strategy toolkit, which Hong Kong actually piloted. That's in consultation with CSM, who are a huge sports marketing firm. That's trying to create assets and create a commercial strategy so they can start bringing the money in. So that's obviously been recognised by the ICC as a growth candidate member, not just because they've got 200 million people. It wouldn't just be because of that. So look, I'm really heartened to see these results, where they might not have gone as well as they want to with the men's T20 World Cup qualifier, although getting through is great. But these two results are great. You know, Namibia came, I'm trying to work, eighth in the Under-19 World Cup two World Cups ago, and
seventh.
Yeah, and then and Kenya, as we know, have been a cricketing nation. Although they've got their issues, there's still a lot of strong cricket being played. So look, this is exciting. Hopefully they're not going to burn out too quickly and drop out. But if we got to see Nigeria in the Under-19 World Cup, I think that'd be great for cricket in Africa in general.
Yes, yeah, they've always sort of had a pretty good local scene, that's although quite small. So it's nice to see them, taking some steps to try and expand that. And I guess it's sort of, this is one of the things that I often say, is that with cricket in these emerging markets, the smart thing to do, I think, is to try and position cricket to grow as the economy grows. And, you know, Nigeria is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. So it makes sense from a financial perspective to be investing in cricket as the economy grows, in the same way as with India. And that's, you know, the time when India won their first World Cup, hockey was probably the national sport. But through a combination of, you know, demographics and I guess wise promotion and investment, cricket's sort of turned into this huge behemoth in India. So I guess if you can try and replicate that in some fast growing economies like Nigeria or Nepal even, or you know, maybe even Indonesia, I think it would be very good for world cricket. I guess in terms of the team, I remember seeing a little while ago Peter Della Penna was talking about them, and when they were in one of the lower World Cricket League divisions, and he said that their bowling was very good, but their batting was had a lot of problems. But it seems like they're managing to rectify that with the younger generation, so that's exciting. And just, I guess, let's not forget Uganda. They've got a really strong crop of younger players coming through as well. So I think they're going to potentially start taking their place as the predominant African associate over the next few years, unless Namibia can maybe manage to turn their form around.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned there, Nick, there's, I guess, a few potential sleeping giants and areas of development that the ICC could well look into potentially fast-tracking. We spoke about last week their discussions of Germany being a potential hotbed of cricket development in the next 10 to 20 years. And I think Nigeria, I guess, fits the criterion of all of that. And again, yeah, you're quite right. Uganda, the senior team have played some unbelievable games in the last 12, 24 months or so, there's been a couple of crackers that they've managed to win in the World Cricket League competition. So they're another African country to look out for moving forward. Boys, I just wanted to quickly discuss Sandeep Lamachane's PSL season. He was named in the team of the PSL for 2019. He was the 12th man in this team, however. I do have his numbers here. He played seven games. He took 11 wickets at 17.18 and an economy of 7.66. And the best bowling figures for him were 4 for 10 in the tournament. Tim, you discussed his perhaps newfound ability of being able to bowl well in the power play, because that's something that he didn't do at the Melbourne Stars. He wasn't really used in the power play. And when he was, it wasn't quite to the desired effect. But Tim, yeah, you noticed that he bowled in the power play and he did it quite admirably.
Yeah, I think watched quite a few PSL games in the end. I think that speaks volumes for my sleeping patterns here in Hong Kong. But yeah, I think that just shows how much control he does have with that white new ball. And I think the key with prevalence of spinners in the power play, especially leg spinners, is that mystery spinner that a Mujeeb is, but also like a Rashid, someone who can bowl a wrong end as just as much of an attacking ball and maybe even more often than a leg spinner. And I was talking to a certain left-handed batsman who's about to re-enter international cricket, who played with Sandeep in the CPL, and he was saying his concern was that people would be able to pick his wrong end too easily. But it seems that throughout that tournament and from going on, batsmen haven't, including in the BBL, even with a lot of video to be able to watch. So look, I'm really excited to see how he takes his forward both for Nepal and in his franchise career, and hopefully he can do it more to get Nepal winning more ODIs.
Yeah, I think I guess Sandeep and Rashid Khan and a few of those mystery spinners, I guess, sort of embody what's become an interesting trend in white ball, and especially 2020 cricket, of spinners being an attacking option. Rather than, I guess, a few years ago, you'd have the David Hussey style darts to just try and keep a lid on the scoring rate. Whereas now they've really upped the game, and they've turned it into an attacking weapon to actively take wickets and knock out a few batsmen early. So I think he's at the forefront of the game's development and evolution.
Well, we'll see plenty of Sandeep in the IPL, in which the full draw was actually announced today. So I guess fans of the IPL will be able to find their favourite team's fixtures for the entire tournament. He'll be once again plying his trade for the Delhi Capitals, as they are now named this year, the change of name late last year.
It's a great amusement and a large amount of money to buy a Twitter handle.
Yeah, it was a basketball team or something, the Delhi Capitals, if I'm not mistaken, yeah.
Yeah, and it only switched over actually during the announcement. I think people were clicking on it saying, look, it's not even the Delhi Capitals. It's already taken by a basketball team. And then it flicked over. It must have been like the deal was waiting to go through, but somebody had forgotten to tell the IT bloke.
Yeah, it's a crazy story. It shows you what the economy and technology is kind of like these days, where things have to happen basically instantaneously, rolled over from one deal to another. Boys, is there anything else we wanted to get at tonight?
Well, I know we're running short for time, but I think a special thanks out to Ryan Campbell, who gave us, I think, another almost 2 hours of his day last week doing an AMA, which is an Ask Me Anything, on our Reddit page, which was great. And he's, of course, signed a two-year extension, which takes him into the middle of 2021. He also mentioned during that was that the Netherlands will be hosting the Zimbabwe team, because of course Afghanistan cancelled their tour there recently for reasons which were a little bit quizzical, in that they wanted a TV broadcast and Zimbabwe couldn't afford it, so talking about DRS and whatnot. So that's going to be exciting. So they're playing two ODIs on the 19th and the 21st of June, and two T20Is on the 23rd and 25th of June.
Yeah, it'd be very good to see how they go. I think the Netherlands are developing into a very strong side, as we saw with the quadrangular T20 series in Oman a little while ago. They've got a very strong T20 side, especially. But even in 50-over cricket, they've been blooding in a lot of good players. And perhaps it'll be a bit of a predictor for how they might go across the upcoming 13-team ODI league, which is going to be very exciting. So I guess it's not that surprising that Cambo's signed up to keep going through that. You know, it's sort of, he's taken them there, and so now he's going to take them through it. So yeah, it'll be good to see how they go.
I do love the bloke, but he did only coach them in the last round, didn't he? So I think we'll give it with partial credit for him taking there. And of course, we'll see. I think in the short term, though, they've got the tour to the UK. They're playing at three different county sides, and then the UAE likely in the UK as well, leading into the T20 World Cup qualifier. So it's going to be interesting to see whether they can get through there. But yeah, I think they got the right guy at the helm there, who's cutting through the guff there and bringing through some good young players. So I think they're going to be an exciting team to watch, both in the World Cup qualifier and then also the ODI league, as you said.
Yeah, I think they've got quite a lot of depth too, which is a testament to Cambo's work. I think Cambo's done an exceptional job at the Netherlands, and they've got some, you know, quite exciting prospects. Not only players coming through, but they're starting to garner some results. So I think it's a good time to be on the Dutch cricket wagon, as it were. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how they go in that ODI league. It's fantastic that they're going to be in that competition. And also another shout out to Ryan Campbell for doing that AMA on Reddit. It's a great read. And so if you haven't done that, I implore you to go onto our Emerging Cricket Reddit page and have a read. He discusses just about everything from scoop shots of the late 1990s, early 2000s to, I guess, the differences between coaching in Hong Kong to coaching in the Netherlands. It was quite a fantastic read, actually, and I quite enjoyed it. Boys, we're going to have to leave it there. Once again, thank you for joining me on the Emerging Cricket Podcast for this episode number 4.
No worries. It's been a pleasure as always. Looking forward to next time.
I'm not sure if you're thanking us or thanking the listeners there, but no, you guys are up late. It's easy for me. I can do this without partners in the background telling me to go to bed. So look, kudos to you both.
It was an overall thank you to everyone, because the Emerging Cricket is a rather wholesome group. Next week, we're going to look at Nick. You've had a chat to Dougal Bedingfield at Cricket Japan. He's got some stuff for us. We're also going to look into some World Cricket League 2 stuff, which is very exciting for us, given that we are going to be in Namibia. A couple of squads have been announced for that tournament, and we might have a brief look at them next week and some other stuff going on. To keep up with cricket's new world, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your favourite social media platform, and please make sure to give us a positive rating where you consume your podcasts. For now, from us, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world.